You're listening to the Physio Matters podcast, and this month in association with the National Ankylosing Spondylitis Society, and this is session 26. Welcome back to the Physio Matters podcast. I'm Jack Chu, and you were delighted to hear that we have another episode in which you don't have me to listen to. Instead, my good friend, colleague and mentor, Jack March, has put together a brilliant session in collaboration with the National Ankylosing Spondylitis Society, best known as NASS. As you'll soon hear, the problem of inflammatory back pain is underdiagnosed, leaving patients misunderstood and often with significant functional and social disabilities. As far as I'm aware, I haven't missed one personally, but equally I bet I have. And so I'll probably have some of my ex-colleagues contact me after this telling me about my shortcomings, because they're great at that. But although I can't tell a tale of a patient that slipped through my net, I happened to miss a barn door case of inflammatory back pain in an interview only last year. In a case study, I systematically missed every obvious clue, mainly due to my desire to dazzle the interviewers with my latest socially holistic care strategies. Don't be blinkered, don't be like me. And so allow me to hand you over to Daniel Radcliffe's voice double, Jack March.
Hi, I'm Jack March, and this month I was lucky enough to interview Dr. Carl Gaffney, a consultant rheumatologist on one of my favourite topics, spondyloarthritis. Spondyloarthritis is an under-recognised condition and often omitted part of differential diagnosis in those with back pain. This is highlighted in a considerable average delay to diagnosis, which currently, I can't help but feel, is unacceptable in this modern era. My guest for the interview is Dr. Carl Gaffney from the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital. As you will hear, he is an extremely busy man, and I am grateful that he gave up some of his valuable time to help spread awareness and increase knowledge about this particular set of conditions. Dr. Gaffney is involved in a number of projects and research around the topic, and is also heavily involved with the National Ankylosing Spondylitis Society, who have generously sponsored this episode. There is more information about NASS during the podcast, and stick around at the end to hear about their most recent projects to boost membership numbers. Finally, listen out for Dr. Gaffney instantly pulling me up on my subtly hidden pun.
So, hello, Dr. Gaffney, and welcome to the Physio Matters podcast.
Thank you very much, Jack.
I'm glad to have got you on board. I've heard you listen, heard you speak a few times, and it's been very enjoyable. Thank you for agreeing to talk around one of my favourite subjects.
And mine too.
Yours too, yes. That's why I've got you on board. Could you briefly outline your involvement currently in the field of spondyloarthropathy?
Okay, well, Jack, I'm a consultant rheumatologist working at the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital. And I am a general rheumatologist, so I see patients with lots of different arthritic-related problems. But one of my special interests is in the area of spondyloarthritis. And currently, we look after about 1,200 patients with spondyloarthritis in our department, which is a big cohort.
That's a lot, yeah.
And as well as that, I've got in other roles. I work with the National Ankylosing Spondylitis Society as one of their medical advisors, and I'm a trustee of the society. I also represent the British Society of Rheumatology at the NICE appraisal meetings of biological therapies for axial spondyloarthritis. And I've also been involved with the British Society of Spondyloarthritis, which is a new research charity set up last year by a group of health professionals to drive the spondyloarthritis research and education agenda. And I'm currently their treasurer, should I say.
Treasurer, yeah. You're a busy chap then.
Well, got lots of jobs, but I enjoy it.
Good. As a consultant rheumatologist, you obviously come into contact with a large number of inflammatory conditions.
Absolutely.
What is it that particularly brought you to spondyloarthropathy?
Okay. Well, it happened by circumstance, really, rather than desire, and I'll explain exactly what happened. Historically, the AS patients, as were known then in Norwich, were looked after by one of our senior physiotherapists, a lady called Alison Gibb, who's since retired. And it became clear when she retired that these patients were essentially a lost tribe. They didn't really have a voice in terms of a medical stroke healthcare professional who was representing and probably fulfilling their needs. And it was around the time that biologics were becoming available for AS. So we were on the sort of crest of a wave then, and there was a surge of interest in this disease area, and there was enthusiasm for research. So it was an ideal opportunity for me as a consultant to take on the mantle and to drive the education, research and clinical agenda in Norwich. At the time, one of my colleagues, who is Professor David Scott, was president of the British Society of Rheumatology, and he proposed that I would get involved with the society on the SPA agenda. Now, I thought at the time that that was probably going to be a bit of a poison chalice, but actually, in retrospect, it's probably one of the best things that ever happened. So I was kind of slightly, not coerced, but I was encouraged to take on this role in the society, and that's probably one of the best things that ever happened. So it's partly fortuitous, partly by design, but actually since then I'd like to think I haven't really looked back, and hopefully the patients in Norwich have benefited from my input.
Yeah, and like I say, I've certainly heard you speak a number of times very eloquently on the subject, and I've found it fascinating every time you do. It's great.
Well, I feel quite passionate about it because it's a bit of a Cinderella disease, and the problem is if you go into the streets in Norwich, King's Lynn, London and stop people and ask them about spondyloarthritis, they'll probably look at you as if you've 10 heads because most people haven't heard of it.
No, exactly. And I think that's one of the reasons that I wanted to get NAS on board to sponsor the episode as well, is that they're going to help promote this and put it out there, and hopefully we can make it a bit more aware around physiotherapists and other...
Absolutely. I mean, it's not just, as you say, healthcare professionals, and it's the public. And within healthcare professionals, it's physiotherapists, as you say. It's doctors, it's GPs, it's chiropractors, it's osteopaths. And within the medical profession, in secondary care, we need to raise awareness amongst ophthalmologists, gastroenterologists. So it's a combined effort, and there's still an awful lot of work to do.
Yeah, see, I mean, if you've got 1,200, not you personally, if your department's got 1,200 patients, that's not a small number of people, is it?
It certainly isn't. And, you know, spondyloarthritis prevalence is approximately the same as multiple sclerosis.
Everyone knows what that is
or has got a few words to say about it, or knows someone who has multiple sclerosis, but that's not true for spondyloarthritis.
No, exactly.
So we need to change that.
Yes, definitely. This is a good start, maybe.
Hopefully.
Or at least we'll help, yeah. So talk to us a little bit about spondyloarthropathy itself. Could you give us a bit of an outline of the condition?
Yeah, sure. Spondyloarthritis is an umbrella term. So basically that encompasses a number of different conditions which have shared clinical, laboratory, genetic, radiological characteristics. Now the prototype spondyloarthritis is what's called axial spondyloarthritis. Heretofore that was known as ankylosing spondylitis. And I think most healthcare professionals are probably familiar with the stereotypical image of somebody with ankylosing spondylitis who has a progressive deterioration with spinal deformity, kyphosis, perhaps fusion of the spine over a number of years. That's kind of the old image, and it's been replaced by a kind of more modern view. And I think that's appropriate because many patients with spondyloarthritis have milder forms of disease, and we've changed the classification such that we now call this axial spondyloarthritis, which encompasses patients with ankylosing spondylitis, but also patients with what we call non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, who have the same characteristics in terms of clinical features, etc., but don't necessarily have structural damage on X-ray. They often have bone marrow edema on magnetic resonance imaging. So the advent of magnetic resonance imaging has enabled us to diagnose and manage this cohort of patients who previously may have been unknown amongst the milieu of patients with back pain in society.
Yeah, just been mismanaged back pain patients.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah,
there's still lots of them out there because we've just published a paper looking at the combined patient population in the rheumatology department in Norwich and Bath, showing that even with the advances in MR, etc., we are diagnosing many more patients. We've had 52% more patients diagnosed in the last 5 years than the previous 5 years.
Gosh.
But the delay to diagnosis is still over 8 years.
Yes, and this we'll come back to that later because
absolutely, not
a great statistic, is it?
I probably haven't answered your question actually very clearly. I went a bit off the subject there. But in terms of spondyloarthritis, the sort of clinical characteristics of the family of patients with spondyloarthritis are essentially the same. The majority of them, if they have axial disease, means they will present with spinal pain. Some of them present with peripheral symptoms,
yeah,
like often lower limb arthritis, large joint, hip, knee, hind foot, sometimes enthesitis, things like Achilles tendonitis, plantar fasciitis. And then there are associations with extra articular manifestations like uveitis, colitis, psoriasis.
Yeah.
So depending on what the predominant problem is, say for example, if it's psoriasis, it may be called psoriatic spondyloarthritis. If it's colitis related, and so on. So it's a kind of a milieu rather than one single condition.
Do you think that's part of the problem, this complexity that leads into this relatively similar diagnosis at the end, but the difference in the beginnings and the...
I think the problem is it's the fact that these patients presented multiple different guises to, yeah, different people with different problems. So often this potential link isn't established, and that contributes to the delay to diagnosis.
Yeah.
It's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons.
If a patient presents to a healthcare professional with new or previously unrecognized symptoms, have you got any tips for suspecting a spondyloarthropathy? Are there any keys you would look for?
Well, I think there are lots of potential presenting symptoms, but the majority of patients will present with back pain. So I think if you have somebody, a young person or who's developed back pain at a young age, and who has persistent back pain, especially if they have inflammatory type features, that should raise your suspicion. Now, by inflammatory type features, we mean pain that improves with activity, worse at rest, doesn't tend to radiate, sometimes associated with buttock pain, especially if it alternates, pain waking up from their sleep, particularly in the second half of the night, improvement with non-steroidals, anti-inflammatories, and early morning stiffness. They're all sort of alarm bells that should make you think, could this patient have axial spondyloarthritis? But remember, inflammatory back pain itself is not a diagnosis. It can be an indicator of many different back complaints. And less than 1 in 10 people with inflammatory back pain will actually have axial spondyloarthritis. But it's a launch pad to prompting you to consider that diagnosis and undertake the appropriate investigations.
Brilliant. Is there any tools that could help someone in the clinic?
Well, there are classification criteria. So there are 3 sets of classification criteria. They're useful for epidemiology studies and for clinical trials so that you have homogeneous cohorts of patients. But I don't think that we can rigorously apply them in clinical practice because they're not that sensitive or specific. So I think it's your clinical judgment and your clinical suspicion. I probably didn't complete my last answer clearly, Jack, but apart from the inflammatory patients, there are another group who may not have characteristic inflammatory pain, but who have chronic back pain, beginning at an early age, under the age of 45. But they will often have other clinical features, either a family history of axial spondyloarthritis, yeah, or ankylosing spondylitis, or possibly a personal or family history of psoriasis or colitis that will trigger your alarm to consider that this diagnosis.
Yeah. So
there are different ways of coming to it.
So a lot of, from what they've said within their subjective history, would be pointing you down that road.
Absolutely. But the problem is, if you don't ask the questions,
exactly,
you won't get the answers.
Yes.
And that's what happens. We did a review of general practitioners' awareness of this disease in Norfolk a couple of years ago. We published it. So we had responses from over 300 GPs. And there were big discrepancies in their knowledge and about the symptoms of this condition. For example, only 60% knew of the association between ankylosing spondylitis and uveitis, even though about 30% of people with AS get uveitis.
Gosh, yeah.
So there are, and that was one of the better ones. So actually, there are big problems.
Yeah.
And it's not, and I'm not slandering GPs.
No.
This could apply to lots of different healthcare professionals.
Yes.
And I'm sure physiotherapists may be in that category, although I wouldn't like to presume.
My understanding is I think they probably are. Yes, exactly. My next question was regarding to recognition within primary care. Is there things you think that particularly people miss? Is there an obvious clinical sign that really would shout to you that often people are missing?
Well, I think it's again asking the right questions.
Yeah.
I think that's really what it's all about. And if you don't ask for the specifics about the characteristics of the back pain, or ask specifically about extra articular features, you'll possibly miss the diagnosis. We've actually, just going back to research, and this obviously informs clinical practice, we've just done a very simple audit at two practices in Norfolk where we've arranged to do a read code analysis on patient databases to see if we could identify patients who had a coexisting diagnosis of chronic back pain and uveitis. And we found multiple patients in really? Different practices. And we went back and reviewed their records in detail. And in very few cases had a diagnosis of axial spondyloarthritis been considered, or indeed had the appropriate questions been asked at the time. So it just gives you an indication of the scale of the problem. And where that paper has just been accepted for a publication in a journal. So, you know, it's quite pertinent and obviously it's something very topical. So big issues in terms of, you know, asking the right questions, but then it's not just the right questions, it's knowing what to do with the patient then afterwards.
Yes, exactly, yes. And you mentioned about sometimes these patients don't always present with back pain being their initial symptom.
Yeah.
Do you think, well, one, you've answered this question already, I think, but awareness that that is the case is obviously not very good. But also, do you think that we should be keeping an eye on patients who maybe attend with an Achilles tendinopathy, yeah, who attend with psoriasis and tennis elbow? Do you think we should keep an eye on those people in case they start to generate back pain?
When you posed that question, I thought that was a bit of a pun initially, Jack, because you said, when you keep an eye on
them.
I know. And I automatically thought uveitis, but that's another story. But
I'm glad you picked up on it.
Going back to, patients presenting with other musculoskeletal symptoms, I think it needs to be in the back of your mind. So, but I mean, most people who present with Achilles tendonitis or plantar fascia won't have access,
no,
nor will they ever get it. But I think it's just something to be aware of. Now, NASS are running a big campaign next year called Back Pain Plus, which is a bit along the lines of what you're talking about,
yeah,
whereby they're trying to raise this awareness that it may not just be back pain, it may be back pain plus or minus something else. So I think it's all about thinking outside the box and not getting too blinkered and focused.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose we don't want everybody filling your rheumatology patients.
No. We're not with a patient who's got Achilles tendonitis.
No.
Could this be axial SP? Unless there are other suspicious symptoms.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. Thank you. So spondyloarthropathy often is described as a systemic inflammatory condition. Could you elaborate a little bit on this and the associated issues this can cause? You already mentioned extraspinal.
Yeah, extraspinal manifestation. I mean, systemic means obviously affecting multiple parts of the body simultaneously. And most patients who have a systemic inflammatory conditions have the sort of inflammatory symptoms that we described, in addition to things like fatigue, which is often an overwhelming problem for these patients, flu-like symptoms, and this can sometimes be mirrored in their laboratory tests where we see raised levels of inflammation. But
yeah,
but not always. Most people will have normal lab tests, so that's another pitfall when we can come back to that perhaps later. But so systemic means affecting multiple systems, and many of these patients will have involvement of sites outside of the spine or joints. And they are particularly the eyes, the bowel, and the skin. Other areas can be affected, lungs, cardiac. So there's a long, long list, but the three big ones are eyes, bowel, and skin.
Yeah, and we need to keep an eye on those.
Absolutely. Well, there you go, the pun again, Jack.
But I'll keep bringing it up.
We need to keep a watch on those, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. And so one of the things that I think we need to do is to raise the profile amongst secondary care specialists who look after patients with eye disease, bowel disease, and dermatology. In our hospital, we've got a good working relationship with the specialists, and we've worked together to try and develop strategies to identify these patients. And we've recently done a piece of work where we've looked at over 300 consecutive patients who've come to the eye casualty department with uveitis.
Yeah.
And through that initiative, we've been able to diagnose a significant number of undiagnosed axial SPA patients. Mm. Of those who presented with uveitis, about a quarter had a history of chronic back pain.
Wow.
And of those, a quarter had undiagnosed axial SPA. So, you know, there's a lot of undiagnosed disease
That's
out there.
A lot of misses, yeah, isn't
absolutely.
It? Yes, exactly. So you mentioned about cardiovascular type issues.
Yeah.
These patients, they're obviously at a higher risk of cardiovascular problems later on.
Yeah, I mean, I think as part of their disease process, they can get valvular heart disease, like aortic disease, or conduction defects. They're quite rare. and I say less than 1%. So, however, there is emerging evidence that people with axial SPA are at increased risk of developing more common types of heart disease, like what we call ischemic heart disease. So they're increased risk of heart attacks, angina, and maybe strokes. Now, that's true of most inflammatory diseases. For example, in rheumatoid arthritis, the risk is even higher. There are a number of studies which are ongoing looking and trying to quantify this risk, because at the moment, it's not conclusive what the magnitude of the risk is, other than say that it is increased. So hence, it's really important that we consider other cardiovascular risk factors in part of the managing these patients, measuring their blood pressure, checking their cholesterol, ensuring they're not diabetic. And the most important thing is advice about smoking cessation.
Yes, yes.
And that's a big problem, because the prevalence of smoking among patients with axial spondyloarthritis is much higher than the general population. Now, we don't really know why that is. Is that because of them using cigarettes or nicotine as a pain management strategy? We don't know. But certainly the prevalence rates are much higher. And not only is smoking deleterious for your heart, but patients with axial SPA who smoke have much more active disease, much more severe disease, more likely to develop structural changes on x-ray. They're much less likely to respond to biological therapies. So there's so many reasons why smoking should be stopped. I kind of got that in there.
Yes, you did. So we really need to be pushing smoking cessation.
Pushing, looking at these other comorbidities and looking at these other contributors or other risk factors for cardiovascular disease, which is something that I think we probably have overlooked traditionally.
And I think that's somewhere where other healthcare professionals can come in as well, physiotherapists.
Definitely, we all need to speak from the same hymn sheet.
Exactly.
But I think we, in our own defense, you know, we you mentioned earlier about missing diagnosis, which I think is true, but it's not so much that you miss it if you've kind of thought about it, but a lot of times we're not thinking about it, and I think we need to keep this on the radar, as you know, people working in the musculoskeletal field in particular, and we need to get all our colleagues on board and raise their education levels and their awareness. I suppose in fairness, though, until biological therapies became available, treatment options were relatively limited. So that's kind of driven the research agenda now, because people have woken up and said, well, actually, this is something we can do something about.
We can keep their SPA a bit better.
Yeah,
now
so it's kind of spurns some research, and that's all great. So we are gathering momentum.
Brilliant.
Which is good.
That's really good. That's really good. Along those lines, it's becoming increasingly common for therapists to be able to request blood tests, radiology.
Absolutely.
Independent prescribing, referrals to people like yourself.
Good.
What would you recommend that someone like myself, physiotherapist in clinic, does if we think we found a patient who might have spondyloarthropathy? Yeah, yeah.
So I think you hit a very important point, Jack, because in lots, there isn't any sort of universal practice in the UK. Depending on where you live, there are different patterns of referral and management. In this neck of the woods, back pain is seen by a musculoskeletal triage team, who are mostly extended scope physiotherapists or general practitioners with an interest. And in fact, I spoke at the education session for this group in Norwich on Monday. And they are like you, they have access to blood tests and imaging. So if you have a patient in whom you have a high clinical suspicion, either because they're young age onset with inflammatory back pain or chronic back pain with other features, I'm more than supportive of them having access to the appropriate MRI scan and the appropriate blood test. And I think that's where it's really important, appropriate. Because in order to identify axial SPA on MRI, you need to have specific sequences done. They're called STIR sequence, which are a fat-suppressed sequence, to enable you to see bone marrow edema, which is the characteristic radiological change or lesion that you'll see in these patients. And the changes are typically in the sacroiliac joints, but about 15% of people will have normal sacroiliac joints but have inflammatory changes in the spine.
So we need to MRI the entire spine.
Exactly. And you need to work with your local radiologist to develop a protocol. Now, there is work ongoing nationally in the UK to try and standardize imaging protocols so that if you went to hospital in King's Lynn or went to one up in Aberdeen, you'd have the same protocol.
Yep.
So once again, there's some standardization, but that's not the case at the moment. There's a lot of kind of variation in practice. And the other big point is that unless you specify on the referral form that you're thinking about axial SPA, you won't get the right sequences.
No.
You may just get a straightforward lumbar spine, no fat suppressed sequences. So you're never going to make the diagnosis on that MRI, and it's a waste of money. So, you know, it's so important that the person who requests the imaging requests the appropriate sequences, or at least guides the radiologist to know what they're looking for.
Exactly.
And the radiologist can action it. But then the other thing is then that we need radiologists who are aware and trained in interpreting the scans, because as you will probably appreciate, and I'm not being ageist here, a lot of the older generation of radiologists perhaps won't have been trained or won't have much experience in axial SPA, because MRI, axial SPA wasn't an issue,
yeah,
you know, 10 years ago. Now it's to the fore. So it's kind of important that we develop a kind of a focus radiology group who are going to kind of take the lead on this disease area, because like all specialties, radiology becomes subspecialized.
Exactly.
So in Norwich, what we do is we've got a multidisciplinary team meeting with radiologists, rheumatologists, which meet weekly. So we discuss all our SPA cases, which enables us to kind of put the clinical picture with the radiological picture and to kind of help support the diagnosis.
Brilliant. And we talked about blood tests a little bit earlier. Anything that you would suggest gets done?
Well, I think the important ones are that you check either the ESR or the CRP.
Yep.
If they're raised, it's useful. If they're negative, it doesn't exclude the condition, because only 30 or 40% of people with spondyloarthritis will have raised inflammatory levels in the blood that we can measure.
Yeah.
And the other important thing is to check the HLA-B27 status, because once again, over 90% of people who have spondyloarthritis will be HLA-B27 positive. But 7% of the population in the UK are B27 positive. So just because you have back pain and you're B27 positive doesn't necessarily mean you have SPA. The likelihood is it's not going to be SPA, because back pain is very prevalent anyway, about 20% of the population of chronic back pain. But it's the most useful test to do in that context where you have a clinical suspicion.
So
I would definitely advocate that.
Exactly. And it's a taking together of all the picture.
Absolutely.
There's no one thing that will tell you this.
So I think if you had a patient whose history was very dubious, but you still had a suspicion, and then the B27 is negative, that would give you more confidence that this patient didn't have the condition.
Yes. Yeah.
And conversely, if the B27 was positive, it would make you more suspicious and perhaps prompt you to refer the patient forward. Yeah.
Should all patients with a diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis or spondyloarthropathy end up with a rheumatologist?
I think rheumatologists probably are really the experts. I'm not saying we're the, you know, nobody can do anything except us. That's not true. But I think in terms of establishing the diagnosis, yes. And should that be any rheumatologist? Well, that's a question, because it's not a subspecialty within rheumatology as it stands. But I think some rheumatologists have an interest more than others, and a professed interest.
Yeah.
And in lots of hospitals now, there are spondyloarthritis services. And about 50% of hospitals in the country have a spondyloarthritis clinic. So if you have access to that, that would seem to be the more appropriate place. But I think in most situations, a general rheumatology clinic is appropriate in order to establish the diagnosis. I just want to come back briefly to one thing that I think we need to just remember, is that when it comes down to MRI interpretation, just because the patient has bone marrow edema doesn't necessarily mean it's spondyloarthritis. A lot of people will have bone marrow edema because of kind of trauma-related hypermobility, for example, stress fractures. There's so many other causes of bone marrow edema. Hence, it's really important to have the team meeting to unravel the whole problem.
Again, the entire clinical picture.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But we're slowly coming around to that.
Good.
I think.
Brilliant. That's great. And we mentioned before about this delay in diagnosis.
Yeah.
So 8 years, I think I've seen anywhere between 6 in the literature to 30.
Absolutely.
Depending on who you look at and where you look at it. Is there any problem with that delay in diagnosis? Is that deleterious to the patient?
Absolutely. I mean, as you know, Jack, the majority of patients who develop axial SPA become symptomatic in their early 20s.
Yeah.
So that's very much a formative phase of life when people are trying to get their careers established, maybe relationships, mortgages, life insurance, all these other things. So it's really important that they know where they stand. And, you know, one of the other big problems with delay to diagnosis is the endurance of symptoms, which could potentially be modified and managed, enabling them to have a much more active, productive life.
Yeah.
A case in point is a gentleman I saw last week who was referred to clinic with chronic back pain and had moved to the area, and his astute GP was suspicious that this could be ankylosing spondylitis. He'd heretofore been told that he had a congenital kyphoscoliosis. And I think he must have had radiographs previous, although I haven't seen them. But he had really advanced. He had a bamboo spine. He's about 50. He'd just recently lost his job. And it was just all awful, really, in terms of seeing the impact. He was so emotional about the whole thing, having finally been given a diagnosis. And this is not uncommon.
No, which is a shame.
That's happening in this day and age.
Yeah, you can imagine the backlash if we took 10 years to diagnose a diabetic patient.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And where would you see the main delays happening? Obviously the rheumatologists aren't likely to be delaying.
Well, I wouldn't say that necessarily. I'm sure they're contributing to it to a degree. I think there's so many obstacles. I once compared this to getting around the Grand National course, like a beach is broken.
Yeah.
Somebody tweeted that, and I still quite use that because it's quite a good analogy. So you've got the patient awareness being poor, population awareness being poor. And actually, we did a work with NASS a couple of years ago, looking at over 3,000 patients and asking them about their journey to diagnosis. The majority consulted their GP within a year of symptom onset. So 80% went to the GP within the year saying, "Doc, I've got bad back, I'm in trouble." But actually, conversely, 50% of them waited for more than 5 years before they were referred on. So there is a bit of an impasse in general practice. Then the next step is getting to see the right specialist. You know, you and I hopefully are AS aware, where we're kind of thinking, could this be, because it's part and parcel of our daily practice. But it may not be for all physiotherapists or all rheumatologists. You know, often patients with back pain can be sent to orthopedic surgeons. I've had patients referred to me through the pain management service. Yeah. You know, so they go to lots of different places, and we don't have a clear pathway. So assuming they get to rheumatology, and assuming they have the correct protocol to MRI, and assuming it's interpreted by someone who kind of knows what they're looking for and recognizes the radiological features, you can see how there are many, many different pitfalls. And then thrown into this, you may have the patient who's self-referred to see an osteopath or a chiropractor, and that may again contribute to the delay. So there's, you can see why it can stretch out for many, many years.
And not turning up at their appointments as well, I've noticed.
Well, yeah, another potential factor, but hopefully that's not a big problem. Minimal. The other thing I think we need to mention is that when patients present, we know that an MRI is the most appropriate investigation. However, some patients are still being referred for x-ray first.
Right.
And if the x-ray is normal, they're deemed not to have axial SBA.
Right.
But in fact, we know that not everyone develops radiographic changes, i.e. changes on x-ray. And for those who do, it may take 8 or 10 years. So a normal x-ray doesn't exclude the condition.
No.
And not every patient who has MRI evidence of bone marrow edema will ever go on to develop x-ray change. Less than 50% do.
Gosh,
and there probably are some differences between those categories of patient.
Yeah. Brilliant. The most of our listeners are mainly therapists in one guise or another. What's your view on the effectiveness of non-pharmacological treatments?
Well, non-pharmacological treatments are really the mainstay of treatment. So in terms of the kind of main focus of management really needs to be on exercise strategies. Now, one of the problems is, and as you know, Jack, it's empowering the patient and patients taking responsibility for their own exercise program. You're not going to be able to be with them on a daily basis as their guardian angel to motivate them and drive them. And that's one of the big problems. But I mean, exercise is by far the most important part of the management pathway on an ongoing basis. Now, I think it's not just exercise. It's exercise combined with pharmacotherapy, really. We did an interesting piece of work some years ago where we looked at exercise capacity and compliance with exercise in patients before and after anti-TNF therapy. And we saw that after they started on TNF therapy, their exercise capacity improved by about 60%. We asked them specifically why this was. And they've said almost invariably it was because their pain levels were suppressed, so they were able to exercise.
Exactly.
So, you know, if you're in pain, the last thing you're going to want to go and do is to exercise, because you will not be able to see the merits, and it may just be too uncomfortable and too unpleasant an experience. So I think we have to factor that in.
Certainly. Mm. And maybe there's an educational component as well with some of these patients who struggle with pain, that exercise can still be beneficial.
Absolutely.
And it's how do we get around that obstacle, as you say.
With and as patients. We know, it's a lot of it is education, because as you know and I know and the well-informed patient knows, is that most patients with axial spondyloarthritis who exercise improve with activity. So
yes.
As they exercise, they begin to feel better. But it's that initial start that's difficult, you know,
yes.
Getting from the chair to the, you know, the pool or to the Pilates class or whatever form of exercise that may be.
Yeah. Talking about sort of therapists in general, anything unhelpful you think that therapists do?
Well, I think manipulation is probably something most therapists don't do now, but some still do. I don't think that's helpful.
Hope they're not doing it on a fused spine.
Well, hopefully not, but it has happened. And certainly that's something we need to impress upon chiropractors and osteopaths, because
yes.
a lot of manipulation still goes on in that environment. So, but beyond that, I think the important thing is to have an exercise program that's can be adapted to individual patients. No size fits all. I often refer my patients to the NAS website for advice on exercise and encourage them to download the Back to Action app, which yeah. is available on the iPhone or Android platform. That's very useful. Engage with local gyms, and if they can afford it, or there's an option to get involved with a personal trainer on the NHS. And lots of different parts of the country have exercise referral schemes, if you know about them,
yep.
that patients can get involved with. So it's very much a case of trying to find the type of exercise that fits in with your lifestyle and suits your condition.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
So it's not one size fits all by any manner of means.
No, exactly. And are there any contraindications in these patients to exercise, like high levels of synovitis or high levels of inflammatory markers?
Well, I think the problem is if they've got very active disease, potentially exercise could exacerbate the symptoms.
Right.
So very active inflammation. So here, some years ago, for patients with rheumatoid arthritis particularly, one of the treatments that was promoted was bed rest
yeah.
when they had a flare-up, because of the fact that rest helps inflammation. And an extreme of this was patients with axial spondyloarthritis who used to be put to bed for months, or sometimes put in plaster casts. And I have patients, elderly patients, who've had this experience, who, when they came out of their cast, were absolutely rigid. So
yeah.
for somebody with axial spondyloarthritis, bed rest is not to be advised.
No.
Activity at all times, if at all possible.
And I suspect because
the danger is you might fuse.
Yeah, I suspect they lost a lot of muscle bulk as well.
Absolutely.
This is just, they're never going to get back.
They're never going to regain,
no.
especially as they get older. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly. So any types of exercise you would specifically avoid?
Well, I think low impact is better than high impact.
Yeah.
But some people with AS can still run marathons and not have problems. It depends on the individual.
So again,
but
tailor it to the patient.
But by and large, people, it's about strengthening, it's about conditioning, it's about flexibility.
Yeah.
So that can be achieved in many different ways. But most people find the lower impact type of exercises better for them.
Yeah, and certainly a lot of patients really like the hydrotherapy pool.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. So NAS runs a branch network
yeah.
of physiotherapy stroke hydrotherapy sessions around the country, and I encourage my patients to get involved with these local branch networks, because
yeah.
I think they're very beneficial.
Yeah, brilliant.
You've also got the, apart from having the actual physiotherapy input and the benefit of the physiotherapist's advice, you've got the camaraderie of the group as well, and
yeah.
that group therapies tend to be motivational and educational, so it's all good.
Yeah, no, they're great. Brilliant. Let's talk about pain for a little bit, if we may. Obviously, this is one of the most common complaints in spondyloarthropathy, and as you said, it's probably the reason people end up going to their GP.
Most cases, absolutely.
Most cases. Do you feel we're addressing pain successfully in these patients?
I think there's probably, if you ask patients what their main priority is in terms of managing their condition, it's pain control. That'd be
yeah.
number one. And number two would be fatigue control. So I think the answer to that is probably not. I think there are many contributory factors to pain.
Yep.
There's the inflammatory pain, which hopefully we can do something for. There's the mechanical pain. And then there are other pains. And a lot of patients who've had pain for some time develop features of chronic pain syndromes, exactly. which can become a big problem. So it's a kind of a multifactorial. So again, it's not a one-size-fits-all.
No.
You need to listen to your patient very carefully, evaluate them clinically. Imaging laboratory tests help you in terms of deciding is it inflammatory, is it mechanical. And sometimes you see patients, for example, I had a patient the other day who's been on anti-TNF therapy for a number of years, doing extremely well, who's come back with worsening pain. But actually, when you listened carefully, it was clear that the pain had a different characteristics. It wasn't his inflammatory pain. It was very much mechanical pain. And I've referred him for an MRI. And I expect he's probably got a disc pathology, probably disc degeneration. That could be symptomatic in anyone. So, you know, people, just because you've got axial SPA doesn't mean you don't get all the other types of pain and causes for pain that other people get. So,
and the persistent pain is an interesting one, especially with these patients who are getting a lot of pain, maybe 8 years before they get any diagnosis, adds a lot of stress.
Absolutely. And it's very difficult to unravel that.
Exactly.
And very difficult sometimes to get on top of their pain.
Do you think rheumatologists and rheumatology services are referring to persistent pain clinics early enough?
I think the problem is that chronic pain services are very patchy again.
Yeah.
And they're completely overburdened. Ideally, I'd like us to have a psychologist or some sort of psychological service attached to the rheumatology department.
Yeah.
Because we've got more than enough need for having a psychologist for ourselves to support our practice, as opposed to the one or two psychologists that are available for the whole of the trust, you know.
Exactly.
Because there's a mountain of chronic pain, and the services are not well enough developed, and there's definitely a need for improvement in that area.
Somewhere else we need to work on, maybe. Yeah, I agree with that one. So one of my final questions, where do you think healthcare professionals, physiotherapists, for example, where could they best improve to help to, one, identify these patients, and two, to manage them?
Yeah, well, I think identification is the most important thing. It's awareness. And in physiotherapy training, I don't know how prominently inflammatory spinal disease features. And I think we need to perhaps look at their training schedule and their attachments to ensure that it is part of the training program. So, you know, to raise awareness right from day one. And then as postgraduates in their training programs or in their professional development, it's important that inflammatory spinal disease feature and perhaps feature during their early rotations during their career, because I suspect that's not happening universally anyway.
I suspect that as well. No, I think there's a push at the moment for direct access physiotherapy as well, and my concern at the moment would be this flood of back pain patients coming who haven't even been vetoed by a GP,
exactly,
turning up at physiotherapy departments and just not knowing what to do with them or recognizing them.
Well, it's the needle in a haystack effect, as you say, because this is a relatively common condition, but back pain is much more common.
Yes.
And there is a deluge of back pain, as we know, approximately 20% of the adult population of chronic back pain. And it's trying to find the needle in the haystack, the axial SPA patient. But there are other important causes. I'm not saying this isn't the only important cause, but it's a very treatable important cause.
Yes.
And for many patients, the symptoms can be reversed and their lives can be transformed with appropriate treatment and management.
And as you say, the evidence of treating someone earlier means that their outcomes later on are so much better.
Absolutely. Well, it's their outcomes throughout are much better in terms of their symptoms, in terms of comorbidities, in terms of work productivity and all the other things that are important to us in life. You know, there's lots of data showing that people with AS, they're more likely to be work disabled. A third are out of work by the time they're diagnosed. Much more likely to retire early because of the disease. If they're women, they're less likely to have babies. They're more likely to be divorced. Wow. They're less likely to be married. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily an indication of well-being, but for most people, they probably would consider that okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are lots of those kind of softer things in life that we don't measure when we tick boxes and assess patients in clinic, but to patients,
they're huge.
And in life, they're hugely important.
Exactly, exactly. Well, I could sit here and talk to you all day, Carl, about
various
spondyloarthropathy topics. I mean, the pros and cons of biosimilars, for example. We could have a whole podcast on that.
Oh, that's another story.
Is there anything you would like to push yourself? Any courses you're going to be involved in? Anything like that?
Well, lots of things. There are a couple of events coming up soon. There's a spondyloarthritis course coming up at the Radisson in Stansted in February. There's also an MRI workshop in Birmingham in February. If anyone likes to contact me, I'll be happy to pass on the details.
We can put those on
my
the,
email address is carl.gaffney@nnuh.nhs.uk.
Brilliant, brilliant. That's great. We must, of course, mention NASWI. They've come up a few times within conversation.
Absolutely.
They've very kindly sponsored this episode. Their website, NASWS.co.uk, is a fantastic resource. I mean, I'm there most days. For clinicians, patients, etc. I would certainly have a look there. It'll answer most questions
absolutely
that people have, I think, or at least direct you in the right place.
I mean, NAS is a wonderful organisation. It's a small organisation that packs a big punch. That's how I'd like to describe it. They're very active on social media. They engage with patients. Their patient information literature is really current. They've got a very proactive research educational agenda. And, you know, they're there to help.
Yeah.
We would encourage patients to become members, but they're more than happy to offer advice to non-members.
Exactly.
So they're not insular. They're very engaging and all-encompassing.
And as you said, there are over 90 branches of the NAS groups. And I think if anybody wants to set one up, then NAS are help very
well. They will help support you or explore the option, exactly. Definitely.
Anything that you're currently working on that...
Well, the things that I'm personally interested in is the whole question of delayed diagnosis.
Yeah.
Working with other specialties, particularly within the hospital environment, to raise awareness and to help hasten this diagnosis. I'm also interested in looking at this idea of GP audits of their patient populations to see if we can actually pick up patients by doing some screening of the GP records. So that's something I'm interested in.
Yeah.
But the other big thing I'm interested in is the whole subject of biological therapies. And I suppose in ways it's a bit about getting the right patients on the right treatment. But then there are lots of patients who are very well controlled on treatment and looking at this idea of dose tapering. In other words, dropping the dose of therapy, maybe on-demand treatment. So there are lots of unanswered questions still. So although we are kind of moving forward, we've got a long way to go.
Moving forward and branching.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think your point about individualizing treatment, I mean, it rings true with every condition, but especially with this one.
Definitely.
Everybody's very different.
Very, very much so, Jack.
Exactly. Yep. Well, thank you very much for agreeing to chat to me today. I think everyone will agree. It's been very informative. I hope everybody's learned something and maybe pick up one or two inflammatory patients. Maybe they've already got on their own caseload and they think about it.
Well, I think it's all about, as I said, applying it to your own practice, because there isn't a standard infrastructure for axial SP in the UK, but maybe you've picked up a few little tips that you might be able to put into practice locally that might just suit your needs and the needs of your patient population.
Brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. And once again, thank you.
You're very welcome.
So there you have it. Dr. Gaffney and I scratched the surface of the complex set of conditions under the umbrella of spondyloarthritis. We really could chat all day about the intricacies of diagnosis, nuances of MRI interpretation, and upcoming challenges around the changes in available pharmacotherapy. As we talk about in the podcast, NAS are a hugely important and influential organisation. I was able to talk to Matthew Briggs from NAS over Skype, and he told me a little bit about their most recent projects to increase their membership. Welcome, Matthew, to the Physio Matters podcast. Thank you for having a few words with me.
Not a problem. Thank you very much for having me on.
Can you, to start with, just describe your role at NAS for our listeners?
Absolutely. So for NAS, I'm the Membership and Information Officer, and my duties are to look after members. I also organise our Members' Day, which is coming up in Bath in June. I also give out information and support with things like benefits, advice on working with AS, and also we look to recruit new members as well.
Oh, that's great. And you've got a project coming up to try and boost your membership numbers. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So we're a charity. We're the only actual charity UK registered that is specifically for people with ankylosing spondylitis. There's an estimated 200,000 people diagnosed with AS, and our membership base is less than 3% of that. And we're obviously looking to try and change that as well.
Oh, that's great. Anything specific that's coming up that you can point either our professional listeners to or any patients that might be listening?
Absolutely. So when we're thinking and considering physios, the first thought we want when they're thinking about ankylosing spondylitis, so AS, is they're thinking about NAS. So we want them to empower people who have AS, and we do that through a few different ways in our charity. So one particular way we look to do that is we need members to help us help ourselves and other people with AS. So At the moment we don't receive any government funding. All the funding we get is from either membership or through fundraising. And what we like to do is to help out with further research and help other people with AS. And this is what the drive in February is going to be about.
Brilliant. That's really good. Well, certainly I'm glad we've managed to have this chat, and I certainly wish all of your members and yourself the best of luck with your projects, because I really think you're a massive help to many, many people. And like you say, if 3% are members at the moment, imagine what you could get done with 50 or 60 or 70%.
Absolutely. I mean, at the moment we provide support, information, advice for those people with AS to manage their condition their way. So we've got lots of different and interesting things on the website for people with AS, things such as our Back to Action DVD as well, which covers different stretches and exercises they can be doing. And also we've got coming up our Members Day, as I mentioned, in June. So this is a great chance to access people who are experts in their area, come and meet other people down in Bath that have got a similar condition to them, as well as come and just join in with something they might have never done before.
If there are any patients listening, have you got any information on how they would become a member?
There's a few different ways they can join. One of the first things they can do is jump on our website, so nas.co.uk, and on there they'll find the Join Us section. It's actually £20 a year to join us as a member, and we do offer some discounts for people with concession rates as well. There's also a lifetime membership, which is £250. That's you signed up to NAS the entire of your life for just £250.
Well, thank you for talking to me, Matthew. I look forward to listening to this whole podcast completed. I think it's going to be really useful to professionals and patients alike.
Not a problem. Thank you very much for having me on.
If I have any words of advice following my chat with Dr. Gaffney, it is this. Back pain is an incredibly common condition, and spondyloarthritis is just one needle mixed in a complex haystack. It is, however, extremely treatable, and as such, should at least be considered, especially in younger people. Looking out for symptoms such as early morning stiffness, symptoms better with activity, worse with rest, pain in the second half of the night requiring to get out of bed, and fatigue is a critical first step. Past medical history and family history of other inflammatory or related conditions is also paramount. Psoriasis, uveitis, and inflammatory bowel conditions, among others, will raise your index of suspicion. Listen to your patients, and please refer to a rheumatologist as soon as possible if you feel there is a chance they could have inflammatory back pain. The delay to diagnosis has to come down, and to be part of the solution, not the problem, an inflammatory cause for symptoms must at least be considered. Dr. Gaffney mentioned the classification criteria, and while these lack specificity, they can be helpful as a reminder of the possible symptoms, associated conditions, and investigations that might lead to a diagnosis. I particularly recommend checking out the ASAS criteria, and links to this, Dr. Gaffney's literature discussed and contact details will be included in the show notes newsletter. If you haven't already signed up, please go to choosehealth.co.uk and sign up at the very bottom of the webpage for bonus monthly content. Follow us on Twitter at @TPMPodcast. Myself at PhysioJack, Dr. Gaffney at CarlGaffney1, and the NAS Society at NAS Exercise. We are also on Facebook. We love to hear from you and to interact, so please do get in touch. Once again, thank you for listening. Here is Dr. Gaffney to sign us off for this episode in the customary fashion.
The Physio Matters podcast, discussing physio matters because physio matters.